Michael shepherded Dorothy out, his arm still tight around her. Dean followed, glancing back wonderingly at the cascade of multicolored fire that poured down the walls. Christy and Doc followed, with Ryan last to leave the doomed building. JB stood close by the door with Mildred, the Uzi in his hands.
You set the fire? Heard a couple of shots.
We had to take out Yehu. He dropped the flaming torch and up it went. Doc blasted the mirror.
Did you kill Moses?
We'll tell you about it later.
Ryan looked behind them. Part of the thatched roof exploded into smoky fire. Sparks and burning weeds were scattered over the roofs of the rest of the ville, most of which immediately caught fire. The young people of Quinley still hadn't noticed the fire, but it could only be a matter of seconds before they did and came running. It was time to move on. The raging blaze, coupled with the death of their god in the flesh as well as their leader, seemed to have totally destroyed the will of the young ones of the ville. Though they came dashing toward the column of smoke and flame, hesitating when they saw the heavily armed outlanders, not one of them made any attempt to stop Ryan and the others from leaving. They parted like the Red Sea to let them pass along the causeway and out through the cultivated fields and orchards into the welcoming shadows of the forest around. Dorothy paused at the fringe of the pines, dragging at Michael.
I can't leave like this. They need me at my home.
There's not really anything much left that looks like a home, girl.
The fire was unstoppable, leaping from wall to roof and back down to the next wall. One or two of the men and women were scooping up buckets of water from the lake and throwing them at the ferocious wall of flame, but it was totally futile. When Dorothy saw the cold gleam of the light purple armor glass walls of the chamber, she shrank back.
It'll be fine. Trust me.
Christy stood behind Dorothy, stroking her long blonde hair, trying to gentle her as though she were a terrified mare.
It'll be all right. We've done it dozens and dozens of times.
But I can't leave my family and my brothers and all my sisters.
You'll have me, and I need you, Dorothy.
We best get on with the jump. You and the girl can sort this out later, Michael. Right now I'd like to get away from here.
One by one they filed into the chamber, picking their places to sit down in a circle, backs against the walls. Michael led Dorothy, who seemed now to have recovered a little of her composure. Ryan waited, ready to close the armorglass door and trigger the Matrans mechanism.
Everyone ready?
Ready as we'll ever be, my dear fellow. Ship shape and Bristol fashion.
JB simply nodded, allowing Mildred to take his hand. She grinned at Ryan.
Ollie ollie oxen free.
Let's go, Dad.
Let's hope we have a better jump than the last time we tried.
It'll be fine.
Ryan looked at Michael and Dorothy.
You two ready for this? It doesn't hurt, but it sort of scrambles your head and you kind of fall asleep for a few seconds. You wake up somewhere else.
And I'll be here for you, and you for me.
Dorothy said nothing, but she was trembling like an aspen in a hurricane, her eyes rolling in their sockets with fear. Ryan closed the door and sat down by Christy, laying the Styr at his side, making himself comfortable. The wound in his neck gave a twinge of pain, and he touched it with the tip of a forefinger. The discs in the floor and ceiling were starting to glow, and the familiar mist was appearing. The darkness was swimming around Ryan.
No. 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 I can't. I can't.
Ryan reluctantly opened his eye again. Part of him saw what was happening, but a part of him was already slipping away on the jump. Dorothy stood by the door, and though she appeared to be screaming, she wasn't making a sound. Michael was on hands and knees, reaching out to her. Ryan struggled to move, but there was a massive weight settled across his limbs, and he was paralyzed. The door opened, and a vague figure stumbled through it. A woman, with hair like Kansas wheat. The shape disintegrated as it left the chamber. The man astride the small black and white pony was lean and hard, with curling side whiskers. The trail was narrow between the tall pines, and he'd heard talk at his previous night's lodgings of there being some big muty critter in the woods. Half the trappers and hunters said it was a humpback grizzly sow,
Others talked about a slewfoot cougar that already chilled a dozen settlers in that part of New England. He reined in the pony and wiped his nose on a torn cotton kerchief. Singing the old songs, best as he could recall them, always made Lonnie's eyes water. That was why he only ever gave voice when he was out on the trail, which was most of the time, selling his handmade blasters and rebuilds all across Des Plaines. His last trip had brought him the whole way from old Seattle in the west into New Hampshire, along the great mirrored expanse of Champlain Lake. On previous trips, he'd been able to do some trading with the young folks at Quindley. They mostly used rifles and muskets. Lonnie generally didn't sell long guns, too clumsy and too obvious. But the saddlebags that Lucifer carried were filled with the actions and locks for all blasters. Quindley, the bill that stuck out into the cold water like a diseased thumb, with that freak baron.
What was his name? Morgan? Mordred? Moses?
But the word of the gaudy where he'd stayed had told of some major disaster in the ville along the shore. A big fire that had filled the air for 100 miles around, with a heavy scent of wood smoke. It had happened, so he'd heard, about a week ago. The survivors had stumbled away as though they were in a daze, abandoning the place to nature. Most had starved, wandering around as though they'd had their brains picked clean by crows. They hadn't known what to do with themselves. Lonnie figured that he was probably wasting his time by calling at the ruins, but you never knew. He'd once sold 3/4 of his stock to a white-haired granny near Duquesne, Missouri. She ran a traveling gaudy and needed some extra protection. Thrown in 5 freebies with her girls as part of the price. He was nearing the end of his sweeping run from west to east. It had been an easy ride with no serious problems, apart from an earth slip in the Dakotas that had delayed him for a couple of rainy days. There was a sister who lived to the northeast on the Atlantic, with gray shores and thousands of hideous spike-shelled crabs for company. New Haven. Lonnie generally called in on her when he was in the area. Now he was close to where Quindley had been. He heeled Lucifer along, wary that the snaggle-toothed brute might swing its head around to try to take a chunk out of his thigh. It wouldn't have been the first time.
Oh, my darling, oh, my darling. Oh, my darling Clementine, you are lost it. Holy shit.
Now he could smell the smoke, charred wood, still hanging below the branches of the damp pines. Ahead of him, as the trail opened out with a view north along the lake, he saw that the stories had been right. Quindley was gone. A few blackened piles stuck up from the water, like the remnants of trees when a forest fire's passed by. The fields around still looked more or less the same, though. As Lonnie drew closer, he could see that rank weeds were already beginning to spring in among the neat rows of crops. He reined in Lucifer, right at the edge of the lake.
Oh, well, waste of time. Mission aborted.
Lonnie had a slight cold and reached inside his pocket for a kerchief, his fingers encountering a folded piece of paper. Lonnie knew what it was and took it out. He carefully opened the written message from those 2 cold eyes up near Seattle. It was to be given to a one-eyed man traveling with a redhead, and a black woman, and an old guy, and some others that Lonnie couldn't quite remember. The older of the pair had been a real triple-jack bastard, eyes like obsidian chips washed in meltwater. He carried a battered armalite like he knew how to use it. The other one was smaller. He'd done the writing, Lonnie recalled. They threatened Lonnie with what would happen if he didn't do his best to deliver the message.
Well, I fucking tried. And enough is fucking enough.
He dropped the crumpled bit of paper into the lake and kicked Lucifer on again, northeast. As the note hit the water, it unfolded like a moth leaving its cocoon. And for a few moments, the words were legible before it became sodden and sank from view. Success. We'll stay around Seattle for 3 months. Come quick, Abe.
Oh, my darling Clementine.
Deathlands Twilight Children is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2006, The Cutting Corporation. performed by Richard Rowan, Terence Aselford, Colleen Delaney, Dolores King-Williams, Nanette Savard, David Coyne, Sonny Lasky, Michael Glenn, Tim Carlin, Karen Carbone, Casey Jones, Kate Torrey, James Konacek, and Mort Shelby. Additional red shirts performed by The Dead Giveaways. Directed by Rick Rowan. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Vocal editing by Johann Detweiler. Graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler and Greg Reinfeld. The Deathlands theme was composed by Mark Ashby. Script adapted for graphic audio by Wilson T. Ferrier. If you enjoyed Deathlands, be sure to look for James Axler's Outlanders, available at Roadstops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net.
So it's day 4. I've been camped out here in front of this truck stop, waiting for the latest graphic audio book. I just can't wait for that truck to arrive and them to open the doors and put them on the shelves. I'm really in need of a new Deathlands. It's about time. I'm almost out of food. Luckily, this is a truck stop, and I can walk in and get food whenever I want, but I've been in this tent for 4 days now. I haven't showered, and it's starting to smell in my tent. And people are looking at me weird. I'm wondering why I'm the only person in line. Like, PlayStation came out, and there were, 100 people in line for, a week and a half, and I've only been here 4 days. There's gotta be a better way.
And there is! Just go to www.graphicaudio.net and order the latest graphic audio titles. We'll have them online before you can buy them in the store. So don't wait, and don't worry. Head on over to graphicaudio.net today.
Available now from Graphic Audio.
Eagles number 3, Talons of Eagles.
Back at the Savannah Road, Stewart had received reinforcements and was massing for a charge across the road.
We better get some help over here damn quick.
Help came rushing up just seconds before Stewart was beginning his charge. And the Union officer held his men back, for he was now facing the massed troops of General Chalmers and Bowman. Jamie's troops were ordered back. He read between the lines of that decision, curved his tongue, and pulled his people back. Stewart's brigade and several brigades from Ohio and Illinois were now facing the bulk of two divisions of Confederates, and they made ready to be slaughtered. But their orders were to hold at all costs. At just about the same time Stewart was preparing the defense, Rebel General Cheatham urged his men forward, and they went charging toward a Union stronghold that was called the Hornet's Nest. Closer they came, then closer, and the Yankees held their fire. When the charging rebels were less than 100 yards away, the Union troops opened fire. Confederate bodies lay in heaps and piles. Some had been blown apart by grapeshot at nearly point-blank range. Moments after that attack failed, Bragg ordered Colonel Gibson to lead a bayonet charge against the Hornet's Nest. Gibson led men from Louisiana and Arkansas into the battle. They were thrown back at a terrible cost of human life. Again, the rebels charged and managed to breach the lines, only to be thrown back once more. Battleground was now covered in blue mixed with gray. Exhausted, Gibson was replaced by Colonel Allen. Allen's charge was beaten back, with Allen losing almost half of his men. Gibson rallied his troops and charged the Hornet's Nest for a third time. And for a third time, his battered brigade was thrown back. Gibson had no more men to give to the cause on this bloody Sunday. While Gibson's brigade was being destroyed trying to take the Hornet's Nest, Johnson was preparing to personally lead a charge against Union troops just to the rebel right of the Hornet's Nest. Jamie and his men had joined up with Jackson's men on the other side of the Savannah Road and were locked in combat. The Marauders had dismounted and were fighting his infantry. Johnston led the charge into the peach orchard, now in full bloom. It was to be a successful charge, for the Union troops fled under the onslaught of Confederates. But it was to be Albert Sidney Johnston's last charge. A mine ball tore through his right leg, and he bled to death, lying on the ground, amid pink peach petals that had been torn loose by cannon fire. The command of the rebel army in the west now was passed to Beauregard. But Beauregard was a mile and a half to the rear at his own command post. So far back from the front lines, he didn't have the foggiest notion what was actually going on. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon when General Johnston was killed. It took almost an hour for a runner to find Beauregard.
Bring me up to date. I need field reports.
If we don't start using artillery up in the middle and start flanking the Yankees left and right, we're gonna be chewed up and had for supper.
Your commander on the right, Colonel?
They're all dead, General.
You are the ranking officer over there?
Yes, sir, I am.
Then you are in command. Return to your position and wait until the last echoes of cannon fire have ceased, Colonel. Then take your right flank and swing your men in.
Jamie waited with the remnants of half a dozen different shattered and battered commands that had gathered around him. Soon more than 70 cannons began to lash out shell and shot from the Confederate side. The cannonade lasted for about 45 minutes, and it demoralized those Union troops it was directed upon, mainly those defending the Hornet's Nest. The rebel gunners were pouring on the fire, sending more than 190 shot and shell per minute into the Yankee lines. The center of the Union line began buckling. Finally gave way. On the rebel left, Jamie and his men charged and put the Union forces into a wild retreat. On the rebel right, Sherman and the other Union generals began to withdraw. Jamie and his men smashed into the Union lines and secured their objective on the rebel right. Jamie, following orders received during the devastating cannonade, stopped its advance and held, allowing his men some much-needed rest. The Union troops defending the Hornet's Nest began to scatter as the word came down the line that it was every man for himself, for they were very nearly surrounded by bloodthirsty rebels. Most of the Union troops headed for the river, or where they hoped in all the smoke and confusion the river would be. Several battered units of Confederate cavalry had linked up with Jamie. Jamie sent Little Ben Pardee, limping badly but very much still in action, galloping on a fresh horse to find Beauregard, get permission to attack straight on towards Pittsburgh Landing. But Little Ben could not find the commanding general, for the general by this time had moved all the way over to the rebel left to join Morgan's cavalry, smashing against Sherman's forces. Jamie obeyed orders and held his position. In the center of the Union line, General Prentice was forced to surrender more than 2,500 of his men, all that he had left after more than a dozen bloody charges against his position. Troops from Iowa began to show the white flag. They were cut off, surrounded, out of ammunition, and their situation was hopeless. General Grant kept looking toward the rear, where more than 6,000 fresh troops under the command of General Wallace were expected to come marching in. It was 5 o'clock in the afternoon of this bloody Sunday. At the river, hundreds of Union soldiers, confused and leaderless, were swimming across to the other side, having thrown away or lost their rifles. Fresh Union troops, almost 40,000 strong, who had just arrived on the scene, couldn't understand what was happening. Union cavalrymen tried to beat the frightened men back with the flat sides of their swords, but were soon overwhelmed by the hundreds of retreating soldiers. As for the soldiers, both Union and Confederate, they were completely exhausted as night fell. Most had not eaten in 24 hours, and they just simply could not go on. Fighting for that day was over.
If you can't find that hot graphic audio title you're looking for, just head to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD or MP3 disc format. Or, the fastest and cheapest way, download that puppy and play it on any of the many devices that'll play Windows Media. And if you're on the road or just a total computer feeb, snatch up the phone and call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220 or www.graphicaudio.net.